the World of RPGs, episode 23, Mexico, part 1 of 2. Welcome to the World of RPGs, a podcast in which we travel around the globe and learn about the local role-playing game scenes. I'm your host, Mo Bots, and in episode 23, we're going to Mexico. And yes, this is a new audio set. Let's see how well that works. So I took a long summer break, but I was busy with running and playing games, so it's not like I was idle. I went to my first convention in over 10 years, I guess, which was the Kraken in Germany, where I played Mythaloria with the author of the game as GM, Dragonborn, famous Swedish game from the 80s, now available in English, Things from the Flood, also from Sweden, Wanderhome, and Fiasco. I also ran the Die RPG and my own game I'm currently playtesting there. There I also got a copy of Amazing Tales, an RPG written for parents playing with their kids, and guess with whom I played this during the summer holidays. We had some great pirate adventures and multiple copyright infringements with Disney if this was ever made public. I also visited Germany and got a bunch of German language role-playing stuff like Hyänenkind. That's an OSR game set in Alexandria, Egypt, but it was actually written by an Austrian author, and I interviewed him in the Austria episode. And I got two games by Plot Bunny Games covered in the third part of the Germany episode, which are both descended from the Queen, Gegen das Monster, or Against the Monster, and Viva la Queerbar. And I got a role-playing guidebook published by System Matters, also in part 3 of the Germany episode. And when I was there, the local game shop Fantasy Inn had its 30-year anniversary, so I got to play in a demo session of Hexen 1733, which we had talked about in part 1 of the Germany episode. It's a well-oiled game, but not for me. It's a bit gamist, and I'm more into simulationist games, I guess. And finally, I ran Ultraviolet Grasslands with some first-time players here in Istanbul. As I'd said in episode 22, we are back in North America, specifically Mexico. Since this podcast is about role-playing culture in different countries and cultures, and we talk about how languages and the country's situation plays a role in gaming, for this episode we focus about the gaming scene in Mexico or Mexican creators who grew up there. I might do an episode on the Hispanic gaming scene in the US, but that's for some other time. Mexico has a population of about 130 million people, and being a former Spanish colony has Roman Catholicism as the majority religion, and most people speak Spanish as their native language, with about 7% still speaking various indigenous languages, mostly in rural regions. As always, I bring up these demographics because they are relevant to gaming. What language is spoken at the table? Which foreign games are accessible? And history and religion can, of course, influence game settings. As for my personal connections to Mexico, there are none. I basically have this thing in my family where I have a cousin who speaks Spanish and is an expert on Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa, and I'm more into Central Eastern Europe and Western Asia. The closest I've ever got was a visit in Los Angeles. Like I usually try to do, the first interview is with the actual play channel we had at the end of last episode. The game played there was Brujo, an original Mexican game.
My name is Jose Galindo. They call me Gali. I started in TTRPGs about probably 12 years ago. You know, like really, really starting, because I played like when I was probably 11 or 12. But I just played a couple of sessions pretty much. So when I really started playing, I was just minding my own business in my work, you know, checking a D&D manual. And a friend came by and told me, oh, I know a guy that plays this stuff. And I said, like, okay, I haven't played forever. Do you know if he's willing to take some players? And he's like, yeah, sure. Let's go ahead and get together some people in the office. And we just talked about it. And we started playing a campaign that lasted approximately like 3 years. So that's where I started getting back to playing TTRPGs after, you know, when I was young. And after that, I started playing a lot of indie games, starting getting to know a lot of the community in Mexico. And then I started creating my podcast with a group of friends. And here we are, you know, starting to make some conversation about TTRPGs in Mexico, in Latin America.
So before we come to the podcast, maybe you can tell us a bit about the scene in general.
I think it's a big scene. You know, it's not as large as probably in the USA or in Spain, but I think in Latin America, it's one of the biggest, if not the biggest one. Probably Argentina and Mexico are the largest countries within the TTRPG scene. You know, excluding Brazil, they basically have like their own bubble. The scene is pretty cool in Mexico. You know, we have been creating together. Before, it used to be like really gatekeeping. Like not a lot of people like to work between each other, or they were really closed. But I think that in the last couple of years, probably 3-4 years, that community has changed a lot. New people have come over to the scene, and that's allowing a lot of people to get together and, you know, collaborate, creating podcasts, creating their own games, their own publishers. So it's really, really coming together. But again, there's this struggle of people wanting to buy games. Latin America has this stigmata, like not official stuff, you know, they download it. I think that affects a lot of the industry, but it's starting to change. You know, people are starting to get together and create their own games, and they know that's value. They're not buying to a corporation like Hasbro or any other big company. If not, they're buying more to independent indies, and that's pretty cool, I think.
Are there shops where people can buy games?
Yes, of course. There are plenty of shops. There are not as many as probably in the United States or in Spain. But yeah, there are a lot of shops, and there are a lot of places like online sites where you can buy stuff as well.
So would these then be in English or in Spanish, the books?
It depends. For example, big companies like Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast, they do have Spanish sections. So we can buy them either in English or Spanish. And a lot of indies, we create them also in Spanish and in English. This is basically because how close we are with the United States. So whether we like it or not, we have the big United States pretty close. So we are used to consume things in English. So probably yes, I normally buy my stuff in English, but we do have a lot of options in Spanish as well.
When you talk about Mexican indie games, can you give a couple of examples that stand out?
Yes, of course. For example, I wrote a game with my friend Ulises from Tirando Rol. The game is called Brujo, and that's a TTRPG about magic folklore in Latin America. You know, like shamans, wizards from mercados, and, you know, the sanctuary, everything that has to do with magic and folklore in Latin America. That's a game that we created last year. We actually sent up some documentation for the Ennis for this year, so they can check it out and see how it goes. There's also other creators like Roll Per Second, who created a game called Eerie Stories, which is phenomenal. Eerie Stories is this game where all the players play the same character, but each one of them plays a part of their seek. One is the intuition, another one is fear, another one is curiosity, and they all get to control the character in a certain way and aspect. And you all create a story based on that. It's pretty cool. It's based in lo-fi horror, which is pretty cool. There's other projects that go to the superheroes like Riftwalkers or Wonderlight, which are really good games. There's also Xena, which is about aliens, and you can be the bad guy in this case, right? You're the alien that wants to control the Earth, stuff like that. There are a lot of creators. Sorry if I missed some of them, but there are plenty of TTRPGs. There are Mexican, there are indies.
Back to mainstream games. So you said you started with D&D, but which other games have you played since then?
There are mainstream, probably, well, Pathfinder. I have played Call of Cthulhu. I have played Vampire the Masquerade. Not my favorite, but I have played it a couple of times. Fate, of course. Masks. I have played also Marvel. Those are some examples that I have played that are like mainstream TTRPGs.
And when you play games set in the real world, like Call of Cthulhu or Vampire, do you play them in Mexico or in the US settings?
That's a pretty good question. I think it depends a lot on the story. If you're playing like a regular setting, well, most likely it's going to be in the US. Times that I have played Call of Cthulhu, most of them have been in the United States. But for example, for Vampire the Masquerade, you know, there's like LA by night or London by night, London Fall, stuff like that. We have created something in Guadalajara, which is called GDL by night, which is pretty much the same as LA by midnight. but in our own city. So yeah, we have played that in Mexican territory, which is pretty cool because you get more used to it. You get the feeling more of it because it's actually the city that you live in. So it actually creates a different experience than when you play in a foreign country.
And a question I have to ask all Spanish-speaking Vampire players. What about those three clan names, Bruja, Toreador, and La Sombra?
I'm not really a big, big player of Vampire. Probably one of my friends, Ulises, and the guy from Brawl Per Second, Irving, they're more attuned with this TTRPG, but I haven't played that much, so honestly, I wouldn't be able to tell you like all the details about the name of the clans in Spanish. I think that the approach is that vampires come from the old continent, from Europe, from other places. So for them, what it's foreign, like Toreadores or La Sombra, for is like more common. And the other clans would be like considered foreigners, right?
Then let's go to the actual play channel. Can you say a bit about that, how it came to be and what stuff you have there?
When I started playing, we got this dungeon master or this narrator, as we like to call him, that started gathering the friends and everything. He told me, you know what, Gali? I want to create a podcast about us playing our adventures and teaching people how to play D&D or any other RPG. But, you know, I need to find the right team. Would you like to help me out? I said, of course, let's do this. So he had a couple of friends of mine. I had a couple of friends that could help out. And we just gathered the group together and say, hey, guys, this is what we're going to do. We want to tell a story. We want to create a podcast. It's going to be 100% audio, so there are going to be no cameras. It's going to be just for podcast audience. Everybody was on board. They said, fine. Some of them haven't played D&D ever. It was like the first time. Others have played D&D for over 15 years. So we tried to gather a really different setting of people so it could work out. So that's basically how it started, and that was 5 years ago. And we already have three campaigns. Two campaigns are already over, and we're starting the new one just last week. So we're pretty excited about that.
So which game is that, and what kind of campaign?
Looking right now, we're playing Dungeons & Dragons 2024 edition. The previous ones were D&D 5e. But we have other like side adventures or side podcasts where we play indie games. For example, we played Brujo, Riftwalkers, Morkborg. We have played Kagure. We have played Primal. Several games that we find. And we try to do like an adventure within each system to show people that not everything is D&D, that there are other options to play. But of course, you know, D&D is like super mainstream. It's what people get first, and then you get to know all the other RPGs. So we try to get the attention by playing D&D, but then bringing them to the whole subculture of tabletop role-playing games indies, right?
I looked at the YouTube channel and I saw this Pirates of the Caribbean style one, which I thought would be cool because it's like Caribbean is like next to like Gulf of Mexico and so on. But now that you say you're playing Brujo, which is a Mexican game, I'll probably take that recording because then it's like from that country, you know?
Yeah, we do have some options there for Brujo, or there's another one that I think it's marvelous. It's called Eerie Stories. That's a really, really great game. You know, it's amazing. And that's in YouTube as well. So if you want to check on the video clip, you can check it over there.
Is there a thing of like different dialects or different regional languages? And does that play a role when playing role-playing games?
The official language in Mexico, it's Spanish. So we pretty much speak Spanish all around the country. However, Mexico has over 60 different languages. Most of those languages are from Native Americans, you know, like Olmeca, Nahuatl, the Mayan, different people that used to live here before the conquest. So yeah, there's a lot of cultural formation, we can say, like a lot of cultural things that can be different from the south to the north or to the center of the country. But that's not something that makes it difficult because the language still is the same, you know, Spanish. But you can see that some words are used differently. For example, in the south, there are a lot of Mayan words that go to the Spanish. And, you know, in the north, there's more words that they use in English. So there's something we call Spanglish, which is a mix between Spanish and English. So even though we have those differences, we can play it all together with someone from the north or the south without no problem.
But are there any groups that play like in Nahuatl or any other indigenous language?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm pretty sure that probably there are some. I cannot guarantee it 100%. That's a pretty cool question. There is something, it's like this group of investigators of role-playing games in Latin America. This is people with PhDs, doctorates, that study how tabletop role-playing games impact. And I'm pretty sure there could be something about, you know, games played in different languages that are not Spanish, such as Nahuatl or Mayan. But I will need to investigate, actually. That's a pretty good question. I think it's pretty important that the communities start working together, not only in their own country, but with other countries as well. Right now, we are doing efforts to get together with Latin America. So right now, we have a really close relationship with Argentina, Colombia, Peru, Venezuela, some other countries that are in the south. So we can bring the community together. We create this international event called Carnaval Rolero, which is like an online party. So everyone can join in from different parts of the continent and share the hobby. But I think it would be pretty interesting to do something like you're doing right now, that not only Latin American countries, but they can be European countries, Asian countries. They all talk together. They all play together. So we can see the differences on how different cultures play at role-playing games.
Next, we get an overview of different Mexican publishers and events.
I'm Claudia. I am originally from Guadalajara, Mexico. I actually got into TTRPGs by accident. I started watching a stream on Twitch, and one of the participants had his own channel where he would play video games by night, but every Thursday he would play D&D. I had no idea what Dungeons & Dragons was, but eventually he made me a moderator for the channel. So I was like, oh, I have to watch every stream to take care of the chat. And I got into it. And one time, since he trusted me, he invited me to fill in Mike's spot because he had to go to the movies with his girlfriend or something that particular Thursday. And eventually I became part of the cast. And then Wizards of the Coast invited us. They would host one of our shows on their channel Saturdays. And they invited us to Los Angeles for, it was D&D Live 2019 Los Angeles. I think that was the name. And we played live there. And that's how Mike and I met in person. We were already friends. And then we started a relationship. And fast forward, we've been married for 4 years now. And I'm moving with him in 2020. And we started going to conventions and playing all sorts of games and running events. And that's how I got into TTRPGs.
Okay. And Mike is also there. So can you also introduce yourself?
Yes. I am Mike Baez, he, him. I am originally from Baja California, so a little bit south of California, but just in the border. And that is literally kind of like the anchor of how I got into games, because culture in Mexico, it always follows on American culture in general, like role-playing games, TV, music, all that stuff. But living in the border, you're more exposed. So 1989, I lived on the border. I was into comic books. I was into fantasy. I was into a lot of already kind of orbiting fiction and narrative and storytelling. And I found what D&D was. So I started playing at a comic book store where they had a group. I saw really old games, because we're talking about 1990 at this point. I was really young. Champions, D&D, Traveler, a lot of old games. But then at some point, and this is kind of be a bridge into all the stuff that we do right now, I took that back to like my cousins, my brothers, and we started playing over in Mexico. So I had to do a lot of translating of the stuff. I had to do a lot of work where I explain all this stuff and how it works, because we did not have a culture of role-playing games over. As it has gone forward, that has changed a lot. When I went to college, I went to Mexico, which is a little bit south of Texas, but this is one of the biggest schools in the whole country. And when I went there, it was another world. I mean, it's college. So off the bat, you're exposed to a lot of more people from different places, different understandings of everything, you know, society norms. But also, you had a lot of people that also had their live-in experience wherever they were. So more people knew about games over there, and college was just an explosion of meeting new games, new systems. This is back in the 2000s. So World of Darkness kind of broke this Dungeons and Dragons is role-playing games. It kind of expanded to a lot of more different stuff. And then at that point, when I went out of college, I went back to Mexicali. I was there. I kind of reconnected with all the people from high school, and we started playing again a diversity of games. This all kind of changes a lot in 2011, because that's when I came over. I live in Georgia in the United States. I am Mexican. I was born and raised over there. I lived 30 years over there. But coming over here for work, I do technical stuff for aerospace. I do project management on it. And that gave me a lot of resources. So I kind of fell into the privilege of being close to Gen Con and PAX and all this conventions and events. And suddenly I met with this friend from back in the college days that was running a Twitch channel. We got into Actual Plays, which is basically something that was not happening in the Spanish-speaking community. Because role-playing games is not as widely known as it is over, like, worldwide, and even less so in the United States, right? It's very common over here, not in Mexico. So we participated in that, promoted the game, showed a lot of people how to play, actually played a bunch of campaigns, and then literally the biggest publisher, which is Wizards of the Coast, kind of invited the whole group into an event. They started sponsoring a bunch of different things that we were doing and putting us on their channel. So that was a lot of visibility. We ended up meeting a lot of people that develop games, not just D&D, but that kind of spread into more things. And we ended up developing a project called, at this point, the Latin Lounge. And what we do in the Latin Lounge is we kind of try and help and bridge and develop people in Mexico and in Latin America that are developing games or running anything that's orbiting them. If they do Actual Plays, if they do like videos explaining the hobby. And then also at the same time, we try and get stuff from the United States and worldwide, and then we take it over to Mexico in conventions. We do it here in the United States. We're working now in Mexico. We kind of took a lot of what we learned seeing the conventions, because as Claudia said, she came over and now we've been 5 years going to all sorts of conventions, seeing how things work, panels, workshops, developing, creating. This year, we became members of GAMA, which is the Game Manufacturers Association. That has been eye-opening because now we understand a lot of the portion of manufacturing, retail, how to help people to pitch the games from the people that games get pitched to. So that's being really interesting to extend our understanding of it. And that's where we are right now. We do all this. We continue to do a lot of effort to participate in the community in Mexico and Latin America. But we are also here. So we're kind of in that gray area between both things. And we also have that benefit and privilege of being able to speak in English and read in English and, you know, just consume a lot of stuff that sometimes it's a problem for accessible understanding of the hobby for people that are in Latin America that may not be as exposed.
Speaking about this gray area, both of you having experience of playing in Actual Plays in the US and in Mexico, do you notice any differences in gaming?
Well, yes. I think we have a particular experience because Mike mentioned that he's from near the border with the US and he had access to learning English and consuming American media, but I didn't. I grew up kind of poor, but I still went to college and I'm well educated. I did not learn English until I was in my mid-20s. So when I started playing with these guys from Monterrey, which is also near the border, they would buy the books in English, not in Spanish, because you have to get them in Spain and they're very expensive, etc., etc. So we play in Spanish, but we take the terminology, but we make it Spanish-like, morphologically speaking, I guess. We say things like castear instead of, I don't know how to say casting in Spanish, actually.
The translation is lanzar un hechizo, which is throwing a spell, versus casting a spell. We actually do translation for games at this point. And one of the things is that is technical translation. It's not just learning the language, it's understanding the technical side of things, because role-playing games are just words. It's just about meaning. It's just about how things are structured in the written form to understand how things work within the context of the game, right? So a word can change everything. If you say you have to see the enemy versus they have to be on direct line of sight, makes a difference. So definitely that is a difficulty. Spanglish is a thing that we do. If you see actual channels right now, a lot of people still use terms in English and Spanish like interchangeably. And that is just in general culture in Mexico. Like we do that a lot.
I mean, that's part of the thing. I remember this one time we were watching a stream on Twitch by some Spaniard players. They were doing like a raffle, I guess. And you had to answer a question. And the question was, what's the signature cantrip for a warlock? And I was the first one who answered. I was like, Eldritch Blast. And when the time from the results came, they were like, so the right answer is by this random person who said Golpe Arcano. And I was like, of course, they were expecting the Spanish term for it. I had the good fortune of visiting Italy a few years ago, and I realized that most European countries do their own translations, and they kind of like consume a lot of foreign media in their own language. And Spain does the same. They translate everything, and we don't do that in Mexico yet, or Latin America. So yeah, that's it.
So what we kind of skipped over when we talked about the actual play was, I was also wondering, since you have experience in the US and in Mexico, outside of the language, do you experience any differences in how games are played or how the actual plays are made between the cultures?
So there is definitely a difference of the culture of play. Like we run a space over in Gen Con called the Latin Lounge, and it's mostly people from outside of the US that go in there and we run games. We try to run games created by Latin American talent. A lot of them are games created in Mexico. They have a different focus. They're more short term. They're defined as just an archetypal experience to sit down and play. A lot of them have like pre-gen creations. There's game Axel Stories. Smoking Mirror is basically the publisher for Nahual RPG. Draco Studios. These are some of the publishers that are more established, that have a little bit more. But then there's self-published games that exist that are by up-and-coming talents that are yet to find where to publish them. One of them, it's called Xeno, as Xenomorph. The pronunciation for the game in Spanish where it was created is Cheno, because that's the pronunciation for South in Mexico. It uses a lot of terminology, like we were talking about indigenous languages. It is one base creator that is creating the game. He inserted a lot of terminology and words from the Mayan languages where he's from. This is a game where you play basically reverse aliens, the RPG. You are the aliens and you go in and you have a mission that is driven by your colony or your lead, which is the mother, a matriarch alien that kind of drives you and gives you your missions and everything. It has a structure of like light in rules, but heavy on theme and tone. I do see like this trend on most of the games being short one shots or like small campaigns, less of the overall structure. This also is socio-economical. Most of these games are small. We either have them as little pamphlets or just, you know, at the most like 16, 20 page booklets, because the production cost is not there. We don't have still a place that can make it for a feasible amount of money where they can actually live through this. But yeah, also, like I was saying, the culture is very playful. In the space of Gen Con and the Latin Lounge, a lot of people that go over there that are American, they're like, I didn't know that this was in this space. I didn't know about you guys. But the energy in the room is different. You guys play and you're very social, which is something that we kind of always hear, even if it's not RPGs. Like people say, like Latin American people are very warm. They're very close. Like you meet them and, you know, half an hour later, they're like, you're their friend already. They share and we're very physical. Like we will hug or have a little bit more of a, in comparison with American culture, we don't have that line to kind of your space, my space. So that also goes into everything. actual plays are very inside jokes, ongoing elements that the players create. There's a lot of ribbing between them. There's a little bit of this culture of creating memorable moments, kind of to expand them to the community. They become like memes or jokes on their Facebook groups, on their Discord groups. That's another thing. A lot of it, and I think that drives why a lot of the games being created in Mexico are more rules light, is because it's less about the crunch of the mechanics, because we don't yet have, like, general audiences are not yet there where they can be familiar with all that or are into all the crunchiness and all the tech that goes into game design. And it's more about vibes, about tones, about what is this game about? This is a game about being aliens. This is a game about being Day of the Dead and you're a spirit that comes back and does something. It's about the story, very narrative driven, I feel. And you, Claudia? Because you had that experience. You played on an actual play with all of us were from Mexico. And then you've had the chance to play on other games where we're invited to play in a lot of different games with people that are not from Mexico, mostly the United States, sometimes from outside of it. What has been your experience as somebody who did that jump, like, straight up from just Mexican to other people?
I also need to mention that I'm a very particular case because I have ADHD, autism, anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not a very warm person, but I know my fellow Mexicans are very warm, very nice. I've seen that it's common nowadays to use the safety tools before you start your game to let your players know what's in your game, etc., etc., to be mindful of them. And that's something that we don't usually do in Mexico because we're not used to that. We are more like, don't be sensitive. It's not a problem. Something like that. Kind of like disregarding a little bit someone else's feelings, not with bad intentions. It's just kind of like how we are. There's a lot of anime fans in Mexico, stuff like that. So my experience started with this group of Mexicans kind of like leaning towards a more Americanized education. I've seen a lot of people nowadays in forums on the internet looking for players for Mexican inspired games, D&D games. I don't see, in my particular case, I haven't seen a lot of people trying to play a white paladin with a very, very white European name in a very white European adventure. That's not something very common, I think. And I'm very glad to see that people, since Baldur's Gate 3 and the D&D movie came out, a lot of people got into D&D. And I see a lot of people wanted to learn to play. And they play these adventures like based on the Let's Explore a Mayan Pyramid or something, which is really nice to see. So that's the thing I've noticed.
The game that we started playing on Twitch evolved into this campaign called 13 Dawns, 13 Albas. It was played in Spanish. This is the one that Wizards was putting up on their main channel over on Saturdays. We played in Spanish. They said, well, we don't want to change anything. We love what you guys are doing. And 13 Dawns was a game that was written and structured by Mario Ortegon. Mario Ortegon ended up working for Radiant Citadel, Dragonlance, a lot of the books from the last 5 years on D&D. So that's the level of game design that was behind him. But also in that 13 Dawns game, we played in his world called Ixalva. Ixalva was a mesh of cultural Mesoamerican history. Like, we played in a place that was kind of like Mexico and Latin America. It kind of took a lot of elements from different cultures, indigenous, modern, contemporary Mexican. And our players all created characters within this world that had elements of all this stuff. Like, our paladin was called Brasca, which is like a South American inspired name. He was a Jaguar Knight. He was a paladin, but he was themed to have like the Jaguar warrior and the shield. His weapon was not a greatsword. It was a Macuahuitl, which is the historical weapon that they used over in the Triarch, which is basically what we know as the Aztec Empire, which is just a wooden pole with obsidian shards. That was a very cultural element to include. So Ixalva and this 13 Albas made us be able to reach a lot of people that speak Spanish but would not be able to see games because that wasn't happening at that point. This was 2017-18. And then that started to grow. Also, at the same time, there is an interest on people. They kind of see it as content that's outside of their regular, because most of fantasy right now is very European centralized. So knights, dragons, all this stuff. Suddenly you have elements like Legend of the Five Rings, where you go and you have a mix of Asian cultures, kind of representative of the general media idea, you know, movie Asia. And then you have elements of Mesoamerican culture. It's fun to go and figure out and see how it differs, because you do want that diversity and a lot of people are looking for it.
I don't know if this is the case for the countries, but at least in Mexico, we need to talk about Mexicans and kind of like there's a separation in the United States between Americans and Native Americans. Since the beginning of the colonial times, there was a separation between those two groups. And in Mexico, there wasn't for the longest run, at least. So by the time of our independence, which started in 1810, we became Mexican. So we are kind of like a mixture of Native Mesoamericans and Europeans and a bit of African slaves. Our culture is purely Mexican. It's not entirely indigenous and it's not entirely European. So we still have indigenous groups, but they are treated very unfairly by the government. They live in their own communities. Some of them don't have like electricity and water, stuff like that. The government has established that they have to be protected, and that's why they live separately. There was an effort a couple of years ago from the government to try to teach indigenous languages to kids in public schools. I don't think it really kind of like worked. But it was a really nice idea, in my opinion. But yeah, so there are things when we play games that are inspired completely on our Mexican culture. For example, charrería, which is kind of like the arts of the, how do you say, lazar?
Horse wrangling, basically cowboy style.
Yeah. That mariachi was also born after the Mexican independence. So we have a lot of things that are very ours. And we can trace their origins way back to Europe or indigenous peoples, but nowadays they're completely different.
Speaking of Spain, because I have already published a Spain episode, have there been situations between like official translations or the books where there was a mess up between Mexican Spanish and European Spanish?
I believe that there's a market in Latin America, but companies have to kind of like take that risk dive to find out, and they haven't. But in Spain, they have done it. There are a lot of publishers, and I think they do a very nice job. The translations are great. They are different from Latin American Spanish, and I don't like that some people in Mexico hate those translations. And I'm like, I understand it sounds different than what you're used to, but you don't have to hate them for that.
I guess it's a personal opinion based on the fact you are a bachelor in literature and that's kind of your world, right? You grew up reading both languages. And I say languages, but really like Iberian Spanish versus Latin American Spanish is very different. Mexican Spanish from, I don't know, Argentinian or Peruvian, also very different. We have words that mean completely different things on both of them. That just falls into play sometimes because what you say sounds funny to us because it means something completely improper. So Spanish has that thing where it has expanded so much, being a colonial language, where then it converted into something specific in particular to all the places that it ended up, right? A lot of people like Claudia are saying do not like that a lot of the translations are Iberian Spanish because to us it sounds like old-timey, kind of like old English to compare to like modern American English or, you know, standard media English, which is designed to be consumed or read or understood by different places. I think the main reason for that is like we were talking about right now, Spain is a bottle market. They are in a place where they like to consume in Spanish. kind of like Brazilian Portuguese, same thing. It's just a bottle market where they had to create their own industry, which is not something that happens in Mexico and Latin America, like Spanish-speaking Latin America. So because of that, Spain has all this publishers, it has all this infrastructure, it has freelancers and professionals that actually can do a living wage doing that because there is an audience, there is a market. Unfortunately, Mexico, because of being so close to the United States, we still have a market that consumes in English. So selling or translating in Spanish has not gathered that strength where it can actually have all that ecosystem where we can do it. So most of the big publishers, most of the games that already exist, go to Spain because they are already situated. They already have this long story of 10 years of experience and of publishing other stuff. What we're seeing currently is that because of all this happening, what's happening in Mexico is more of a rootgrass movement where creators are self-publishing, are building their own stuff in our language and literally in their own regions or ecosystems. And that is healthy. That needs to happen so that it begins to grow, more people know about it, and then we can professionalize that hobby that turns literally into an industry. So it's good to see that happening, but we're not there yet. So there is still a very large dependency on publishers that are in Spain, and the language is different. There is still a struggle to understand, just like Claudia was saying, that example of Eldritch Blast turned into Spanish. Well, just off the bat, again, technical, very specific language. Eldritch doesn't have like a very particular translation to it. And then Blast is kind of something that got turned into basically Arcane Punch or Arcane, you know. Same thing happened with, there was one adventure for D&D that came out called Dragon Heist. Basically, it's a big criminal plan to break into something, and it's called Dragon because that's the name of the coin. But in Spain, they call it
Golpe de los Dragones. Which is correct, by the way. Golpe can mean punch or heist, depending on the context.
Yes, but culturally, Spain was more familiar with it. And it also played into like this big movie that was a classic that already had kind of that structure in the name. So for them, it was like they saw it and it was like it makes complete sense. But then people that are Latin American, they were like, what is that? Like, that sounds like a kung fu movie. Like, you know, the dragon punch basically is what it translates to us in the context of culturally understanding the reference for it. So there is a bit of that. It's never a conflict, really. Like, we appreciate that the games that we have are coming into the language, even if it's separated, you know, by the ocean, into just a little bit of a difference. But definitely there is a push and a request to have the language be a little bit more neutral when it's Spanish so that it can use also translators from Latin America. So there's a middle point where you use references to both things and it's not as jarring or as difficult for people to get into it.
Yeah, I think one of the issues for people in Spain was that Wizards of the Coast took back the translations in-house, and the in-house translators would be Mexican-Americans, and so the 5e books would be in a kind of Latin American Spanish. That weirded out some people in Spain. And also the translation of Rogue, I think, was an issue from European Spanish.
Yes. Picaro, which is a medieval Renaissance name for somebody who's just, is more of a troublemaker rather than a rogue. But also rogue is difficult to translate because rogue is just somebody who's outside of the norm and whatever. Culturally on English, we understand what that is.
Also, we are very nasty people. So it can mean someone who is kind of like a perv.
So that's the other, I wouldn't say nasty. I would say there's culturally in Mexico has this picaresque way of trying to turn everything into puns or into double entendres where you say something and it turns into something either sexual or something that's just funny or, you know, subtle ribbing of somebody else. So definitely Mexican culture kind of falls into that a lot where they see something and if it has that little, it can be interpreted or something else, they will do it. It's jokey, it's playful, but it does change the way that we approach things. It also has to be very careful to not use a name that definitely can be misinterpreted or something off color.
You talked about some local Mexican games. And in the pre-talk, you also, Claudia, mentioned you were working on some. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So when I started playing games in 2016, and by 2017, there was a project launching on Kickstarter called Nahual RPG by Mexican game designer, who's also called Miguel Espinosa. And our host invited him to run a game for us to play test it live. And that's how we met him. Nowadays, he's a friend. Mike and I worked on the upcoming supplement, which that's all I can say about it. It's called Dream Wars. But Mike mentioned that I have a bachelor degree in Hispanic literature and Spanish and proofreading. And Miguel hired me to do the Spanish proofreading of the Spanish version of the game and the Spanish revision of the Spanish terms in the English version. That's how I worked for him. I had to read the book like twice. And then he works for Magpie Games, which is Albuquerque-based games company. One of the owners, his name is Mark Diaz. He's also of Mexican descent. I think his mother is originally from Mexico, and he wanted to write a game about narcos, basically, which he acknowledges is not a topic for everyone. But he invited us to write for the game. Mike and I wrote a couple of NPCs. We created NPCs with names and drives and backstories for Master of Ceremonies to use in the games. And he also invited me to write a couple of playbooks for the supplement called Amigos y Enemigos, which is not out yet, I think. And it can be a lot of fun if you play, depending on who you play with. But yeah, I know it's not for everyone. But I had a blast writing these two playbooks. I wrote La Mariachi, which is a musician from Mexico. And what was the other? Basically, the corrupt lawyer. And he mentioned that he wanted to give me that opportunity because I'm a woman and he's very social conscious about those things. There's another game that Magpie published called Pasión de las Pasiones, which is basically telenovelas or soap operas. And I did the Spanish revision of the Spanish terms in the game, as well as wrote the cultural annex. Basically, they asked me to make a name generator for players to generate their very dramatic telenovela names. Also, famous songs from famous telenovelas from Latin America. Places where they can play.
I guess it's a lot of cultural elements that were added to the book. The creator of the book is not actually Mexican, but obviously exposed to all this Latin culture through telenovelas, which go all the way to South America.
He's from Peruvian descent.
So he wanted to connect with other people that were in the space in Mexico that were more familiar so they can bring some authenticity to the items that were going to be sprinkled around. Definitely the trope and the archetype for telenovelas is just drama, histrionics, you know, all this double crossings and intrigue and personal relationship, you know, passion, literally. So that he got really well, but he wanted to do all those specific details that actually resonated with people that would be familiar with actual telenovelas. So I also work in Nahual RPG. We did the play testing. We were pulled in with Miguel. There's a term in Mexico called tocayo, which is people that share the same name. So that was an instant connection, and we just kind of bonded really cool about it. We were able to meet each other in the conventions here in the United States once, where we actually played Nahual, like in the apartment that we were staying at. And that kind of drove into, like, let's continue to work together. That's how we ended up in Dream Wars, this second supplement from the Kickstarter for the base core Nahual RPG game. Fantastic game, a PBTA, which also led to him having us meet Mark Truman Diaz. We ended up working in Cartel RPG, Pasión de las Pasiones, through all the efforts that Claudia was doing. And going through conventions, we met other people, mostly people of color, because that's where we gravitate a lot into the spaces in games. It has to be said, and I don't say this, it's kind of a matter-of-factly thing to say, but the TTRPG space has a lot of American white male people creating. So historically, there has been a great difficulty to have diversity and to have representation of other people. That has been changing. A lot of the publishers have found that. A lot of the publisher leads have kind of driven into getting more exposure of different games, different things, different elements, because we're just enriching the play space. Definitely our space on working on games initially was pulled into the cultural resonance that we had. So Nahual is a very Mexican contemporary game, is modern urban fantasy. Cartel is literally something we lived in. Guadalajara is a place that is just affected by narco terrorism. I live in Baja California, which is near Tijuana. That is one of the most narco-infested places. So we were talking about our own experience. And also, when we decided to work in it, one of the elements we did talk to Mark is we wanted to make it real. We don't want this to be a caricature. We don't want people to be playing this to make it a romantic version. Because nowadays, it's like if you talk about mafia games, it's these cool characters that are roguish and they do this illegal things and everything. But it is normalized at this point. Nobody sees it as a bad thing in the general sense. And we don't want that to happen. Cartels and narcos are bad things, but they're part of the human experience that we live, especially when you live in Mexico. So one of the books that we worked on, Amigos and Enemigos, means friends and enemies. We created NPCs that you can put into the stories that you have, and they have pre-coded, like, this is their archetype, this is what they want, this is what you can negotiate with them. And a lot of them is like lawyers, is like a mother that lost her son because the son went to work for the narco and she's looking for him. You have somebody who's an actual politician that is trying to do the right thing. So inserting those things made it so that we felt like we were not making this about like narcos being cool, but of the human conflict that comes with it. Also beyond that, and that is something that goes into the balance, you normally do not want to fall into a box. We do not want to be just creators and designers for games that are literally only about Mexican culture. So we have had the possibility. I mean, we play tested for Wizards of the Coast. We've had the chance to play test for Beetle and Grimm. MT Black, one of the most prolific writers in drive-through RPG and DM's Guild, somebody I met through conventions, and I ended up playtesting a lot for his games, mostly adventures, fantasy, and then he just came out with a World War II analog where it's a different world. There's magic in it. So going beyond what's our live-in experience also validates a lot on you're not just a Latin American Mexican creator. You also create in other environments because we love this hobby. I also had the chance to work with Aaron Lim. He's from Malaysia. He had a game come out called Spectres of Broken. We were able to play test in another convention where we met. We talked about it. Both of us were our project managers in our day jobs. So we connected through that. We started talking. And then I was talking to him. And being Malaysian, he was like, yeah, we're exposed to all this. Spectres of Broken is a game about mechas, about young pilots that go to a first phase where they're young, they meet the other people they work with. And then there's a changing event, massive event that starts a war. And basically the group of young people that initiated and learned to pilot the mechas end up on different sides of the war. And the conflict is that there's no enemy, there's them just having difficulties and differences, philosophical, and, you know, and that was amazing because I was telling him in Mexico, like Robotech, Macros, Gundam, all the shows came to Mexico late in TV. Like we were seeing them in the 90s and the 2000s. Same thing with like Dragon Ball and Naruto and all this anime. We always in Mexico get all the stuff later. Back in the 80s and the 90s, it was like 10, 20 years late. Right now, it's more close because now the world is different and we are way more quick on turning all those things and getting them to more people in different languages. But I grew up with that. I was telling him, like, I grew up on all those cartoons where, like, pilots and mechs and romance and drama and conflict. So I ended up being able to work with him beyond the playtest, and we did, like, a follow-up book with specific settings, and mine was very much Evangelion, Macros, Gundam. So that is cool. It permits us to connect with other creators and be able to just work outside of the cultural spot that we lived in. I would just like to close where Mexico is in a lot of ways in a growing situation still. So a lot of the, in general, culturally and socioeconomical, we are in a place where there's a lot of opportunity to grow. Hobbies and TTRPGs are one of those things. I really strongly believe that TTRPGs as a hobby are a huge improvement to the life of everyone that can get exposed to it. So that's one of the reasons why we promote it. That's one of the reasons why we created the Latin Lounge. We try to bridge and give tools to everyone that we can because we understand it's a privilege to be here and be able to talk to the people that we talk to, have contact. We work with Free League, Paizo, Wizards of the Coast, South the Funeral, Indie Press Revolution, Magpie. This is huge publishers that are doing a lot of work and we're trying to connect to other creators so that they can also kind of be able to participate or give us tools that we can also kind of grow the things over in Mexico. Axo Stories, Smoking Mirror, Draco Studios. These are our publishers that are growing over in Mexico. We want to continue to support them. The Veer is the biggest publisher in Latin America and Spain. They do a convention called Mega XP. It's in Mexico City. It's the biggest one in Latin America. It is amazing. We banded together a bunch of projects that were doing TTRPG stuff. And a couple of years ago, we initiated a space and we negotiated as a group called Rol en tu Idioma, which is role-playing games in your language, basically, so that we could go there, have booths, present our games, run the games, explain to people what TTRPGs are, and kind of make it a presence that never goes away in those events. It has been fantastic. It has grown every year. It's been 3 or 4 years at this point. Next year, they're going to do, I believe for the first time, they're going to do 2 conventions because now they don't have enough space for all the people that want to go. So one is going to be in April and the other one is going to be probably third quarter or fourth quarter. So that is healthy. It means that more people are getting exposed to these games. And definitely there's that guerrilla effort where everyone in their regions with their projects are trying to make the same thing in different spaces. We have different states where people that we know that we meet together in this, like the big show, like the prom. The yearly prom for role-playing games is Mega XP. But then we go, we meet, we talk about things, and then we see different states have their own regional events. They start doing promotion for, we're going to be in this place, we're going to run games, we're going to be selling these games, we're going to be presenting what they are. So that is where we want to be right now. There's still a lot to cover. There's still a lot of road to walk. But all the creatives that are being participant on this, I think are making it so that it's still growing. It has momentum. So hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll see a lot of additional games, additional projects, more presence in multimedia. So yeah, I think the future is bright.
So thank you for listening to episode 23, part one. As Michael said, the future is bright. So you can hop right over to part two, where I talk to some regular gamers, a gaming researcher and book author, and the creator of the Nahual RPG.